Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Clean Energy View Radio Show. Our podcasts are available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website at www.cleanenergyview.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, or contact me directly at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at info@cleanenergyview.com.
Today, my guest is Tom Drolet, and we're going to be talking about if diversity is the key to the future of clean energy. The paradigm has shifted, and the days of relying upon mature energy are numbered. While the race is on to find what seems to be a, quote, one-size-fits-all solution for sustainable energy that will eliminate our dependence upon fossil fuels, perhaps we should be looking at more than one source. Can diversity be the key to the future of sustainable clean energy? Well, on today's show, I had the pleasure of talking to Tom Drolet, who's the president of Drolet & Associates Energy Services. Mr. Drolet has worked in the energy industry and technology innovation industries for over 42 years. He brought a wealth of experience at the senior management level to the electrical utility industry at Ontario Hydro, the fourth largest electrical utility in the world, and also DTE Energy. And he's worked on several boards of directors and in the oil and natural gas industries in North America and on renewable energies in North and South America, Japan, Indonesia, and in the Philippines. He's also worked with several new technology industries in the areas of energy, fusion energy, distributed generation, fuel cells, and innovative geothermal processes, as well as in the area of medical pharmaceutical breakthrough applications and cancer treatments. In the last 25 years, Mr. Drolet has worked internationally in 44 countries, predominantly in North America, South America, Australia, China, Russia, South Korea, Japan, Africa, and Europe. He has spoken at over 175 major conferences on issues in energy and the effects of new technologies on the economies of the Western world. So I would like to welcome to the show Mr. Thomas Drolet. Good afternoon, sir, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, June. That was quite an introduction. It certainly sounds like I either can't keep a job or don't have a house. Moving all over the world so many times, and that's the truth.
You sound like the Johnny Cash of energy.
That's right. Well, the energy is still there, but it's as age goes, the energy does decrease, I must admit.
One fascinating fact about you is that you have been to both nuclear plants in Japan and Russia. Can you talk about that?
Well, the way we talked about it in preparation for this, June, was related to incidents and accidents that have occurred at some of the nuclear reactors in the world, which has sure set the nuclear industry on its ear lately. But the ones that I was at were at Chernobyl over in Russia way back April 26, of course, 1986 was the catastrophic accident at Chernobyl where a RBMK 1,000 megawatt reactor basically blew its top because of a combination of bad equipment but predominantly operator error. At the time, as a Canadian, I was sent from my company along with three others over to Russia to see if we could help out. And we worked with Russian engineers and scientists to try and impart knowledge on methods of radioactive waste disposal, trying to snuff the prompt critical pile that was still spewing radioactivity in the air, a variety of things. It was certainly something that will be in my memory for my long life. I'll never forget it. And most recently, of course, we have the Fukushima Daiichi plant and the accident there, which was caused by an act of nature but resulted in some mechanical equipment failures. Predominantly, the diesel gen sets and battery systems were overwhelmed by water leading to overheating of the fuel, resulting in hydrogen explosions that damaged the plant severely. The Japanese energy industry has been set back mammothly by that accident, and from my involvements, I would say that they're probably in the $120 billion range and 10 years just to take that particular site back to a greenfield operation. But I don't want to leave you with the fact that that's all that nuclear power is all about. There are some 435 nuclear power reactors in the world that are working just fine, thank you, and providing baseload electricity, which is needed for our urban-centric world, and are doing just fine.
One country in particular where that's the case is France. How is it that they seem to be moving along fine and other countries have had difficulties?
Well, the French basically have 58 reactors operating today, providing, and I'm going to round these figures off, 80% of their day-to-day electricity. The French took a route that our more free market enterprise route here in the United States did. What they did is they said, we're going to adopt one technology, one type of plant, and we're going to cookie cutter our way to building many. Now, let's look at that strategy. That strategy works really well, and it has, if you don't have any generic faults. Because if you have a generic fault, for instance, a steam generator design that didn't work, you've got 58 plants that don't work.
Mm.
But in this particular case, they went about it methodically and pedantically, and they have today a system that operates very well.
It's really interesting that nuclear can operate so safely, and then you look at what you've seen firsthand, it's just mind-blowing.
It is, and I want to get back to a point I mentioned a little bit earlier, and that is when you look at the makeup of our electricity system today, it's a system that requires a balance of sources. And what I mean by that is that we live in predominantly cities. It's an urban-centric world we live in more and more every day. And we need dense power systems producing dense sources of energy like nuclear power, like some of the fossil power systems, in order to give you that base load capability always on, 724/365, always available. And then you can augment or balance that system with more peaker-type plants. If you get in trouble and there's a sudden rise in temperature and the air conditioning load goes up the scale, when you bring in your diesel gensets, your solar, your wind, anything that you can in order to meet the load of the system. So speaking as an ex-utility operator type of person, I can't just have one source. One size does not fit all in the electrical business today and never, ever will. What you have to have is a balance of sources to meet the ever-changing load demand in society.
How can we go about looking at a myriad of technologies that we should really develop and also make it effective so that the money is well spent, but also it makes sense? Because it just seems as though when it comes to clean energy, there's so many different things that are going on, it's very convoluted.
Oh, there are. There are so many great technologies coming up the pipe these days. And just to mention a few, biofuels, solar, wind, all sorts of end-use products that are going to take some of those sources of energy and use them more efficiently, and we can get into things like different types of mode of transportation using electrical or air even, all sorts of different technologies. We have, on the biomass front, we have anaerobic digestion, we have mass burning, we have methane production from municipal waste piles. All of these things point to a world where distributed generation, or more small generation sources, can feed actively into the system and give you better reliability. What do I mean by that? If it's like my portfolio. I'm not going to put all my money in the stock market in one stock. I'm going to vary it around. That's just smart, because any one company can have a problem and there goes your money. Same thing in the electrical industry. The more varieties of different generation sources you have, ergo, the more reliability you have. So we should be developing all of these sources. Now, we can also have a discussion, June, about how you fund those sources. Who's going to invest in them? Should it be the nation state, or should it be private industry? But the more, the merrier.
Do you think that most of the technology will actually come from just different people that are not necessarily heavily invested in a particular industry, but are just looking for resources, and because of that need, develop the innovation?
Well, you're talking about what can the little guy do?
Yeah.
Well, what the little guy can do, for instance, just here locally in Florida, where I happen to live, there's all these municipal waste dumps where private industry is coming in and saying, hey, Mr. Municipality, how about I put a methane collection system in your waste dump, and I put in a little generator on top of that, and then I generate electricity and feed it into your local grid at a power rate that's acceptable to make a modest return. That's just one example. Putting solar collectors on business roofs, that's a major, major thing that each and every small business can do to help offset the load. Now, right now, the return on that investment is not your normally acceptable high finance type thinking about 4, 5, 6 years. It's probably upwards of 15 to 20 years. But let's start developing those as much as possible. And then when we get into the issue of how do we pay for it, and the question about nation-state contributions versus individual business decisions, I personally come down on the side of things like tax credits and so forth. I'm not an advocate of major subsidies and grants into these different systems, be they solar, wind, solar rooftop stuff, and so forth. Why do I think like that? I think the real position of our governments is to invest in the research and development that makes these new technologies better, so that their returns on investment when they're in the hands of private industry can be more normal. That's the way the free market works, I believe, and I'd like to see that tendency pushed rather than wholesale subsidies for some of these new systems.
Now, doesn't it seem as though the big energy companies are still holding on tight to, you know, mature technologies that are not going to be around for much longer, and it just doesn't make much sense as to why they're not pushing full steam ahead into some of these emerging technologies, which rely upon abundant resources that are otherwise not even being utilized?
Yeah, June, you're bringing up the fact that we live in a self-centered world, don't we? Some of the major companies, be they oil companies, coal companies, a lot of companies, they're in business to provide a specific product. And so, of course, they have to be self-centered and self-focused on that business, because they have to return something to their shareholders, and that's the way it is. But more and more of them, and I'll name a few, people like Duke Energy, just a big utility in the United States, Pacific Gas and Electric, DTE Energy, Florida Power and Light, and I know I'm missing many, many, many. There are utilities that are, in fact, going along this new blazed path for bringing in alternate energies like wind, like solar. And I think they're the types of leaders that need to spread that word to the rest of them that just don't get the message yet. And I hope they do start to get the message of diversification and supporting all of these new things, because it's in their interest in the long term.
Now, speaking of solar, how can the solar industry recover from Solyndra and also the private investor losses?
Well, there was an example, of course. I can't remember the numbers, but whatever the loss was, $575 million or something like that, was a major loss because it was a grant or a subsidy, a direct subsidy for an industry to establish, I think, a couple of manufacturing plants. And what went wrong there were two things. Foreign competition undercut their price, and secondly, their technology was not good enough. Two things I'll say about those two issues. Number one, when it comes down to what is blatantly unfair foreign competition, in this particular case, China, and it was dominantly China, who are subsidizing their industries massively, they just undercut their price sheet, period. Next, there was a technology failure. Some of these solar panels just couldn't stand the heat, so to speak. Mm. They're up on the roof, and they just didn't work as well in the hotter environments, which is kind of ironic. So it brings me back to my particular focus, which is that's the place for government R&D. That's the place where governments can use our taxpayer dollars more efficiently by putting them into laboratory settings, solve these problems, because solar has a fantastic future. It truly does. Look at all the sunshine down in the southern tier of the United States, even up into the middle and parts of the north where the cloud cover isn't too much. Those are all areas that can use solar energy on business rooftops and eventually in retail or housing rooftops, but only when we do some more R&D. So I guess what I'm saying is, Mr. Government, put your dollars in R&D. Don't subsidize plant sites.
Thank you. Now, in regards to some of the work that you've done an awful lot of work on geothermal. Can you talk about your work and what some of the benefits are and what else we can do with it?
Sure. Geothermal, what I'm talking about here is not geothermal in the sense of your house where you get a local contractor to come in and put down a pipe that basically takes the temperature difference between subsoil, say 30, 40, 50 feet below your house, and the air temperature, and then drive your electrical systems based on temperature difference. That's what I call just local geothermal. I'm talking about heat of the earth type geothermal. If you look at the way the earth is constructed, certainly along certain fault lines, let's talk about the Ring of Fire for a moment, that area all the way up the western coast of South America through the western coast of the U.S., Alaska, around Japan, into the Philippines and Indonesia. That's all where the Pacific and North Atlantic and Asian plates are all in movement. And that causes the hot material from the core of the earth to approach the surface to a greater extent. So what the geothermal business is doing today, And there are about, I probably got my numbers a bit wrong here, but roughly 3,000 megawatts of electricity is being generated baseload, always on, predominantly out in California, Alaska, Oregon, Utah, areas along that sort of tectonically active area. What you do is you drill down anywhere from 1 to 2 miles, 5 to 10,000 feet, and the interstitial water that's in the rock, the hot rock that's down there, rock that's anywhere from, say, 150 degrees C right up to 300 degrees C. That water comes up. Of course, as it approaches the surface, it flashes to steam and goes in a conventional turbine generator and off into the power grid. There are a wholesale number of plants up in the Geysers Field, for instance, north of San Francisco, north of Healdsburg in the Sonoma Valley, down in Southern California in the Imperial Valley along the Mexican border. These plants are feeding directly in really good, clean, renewable energy to the grids of California and the west coast of the U.S. Happening all over the world, too. There's a gigantic amount of hot rock with water in the Rift Valley in Africa throughout Kenya, Tanzania. There's another field that's in sort of the mid part of Italy, in Tuscany area. And finally, in Indonesia and the Philippines, they're some of the best fields that we have available. All of that is being developed right now and generating, I think, worldwide, a total of some 9,000 megawatts of geothermal energy. You asked about new developments. In that area, there's a thing called enhanced geothermal energy, where they're looking for a method. It's under R&D right now. I'm not holding out hope in the near term for it, but perhaps in 10, 20 years, we'll have enhanced geothermal energy where all you do is drill two holes instead of a whole field of holes to get steam up. And you pump water down one hole, say 2 to 3 miles, even deeper, to get right down there. Look for a horizontal fractured system where that water can now flow by pressure through the well up to another well. It absorbs heat as it travels from one well bottom to the other, up, turns a turbine, generates electricity. And there's even a final one where they can do it with a single hole, very much an R&D exercise these days. And they're looking for a grout-like material that actually just collects the heat from the ground. And then that is transferred to a heat exchanger and then off into the generator at the surface. I like to think of geothermal as a base load renewable energy system that can, with time, become more democratically available. I mean democratic by widely available in the world. Mm-hmm. And it will only be so if we can get the R&D done on this enhanced geothermal and be able to drill holes almost anywhere, because you have to go deeper when you're not close to a tectonic active zone.
Thank you. And just out of curiosity, you're very well traveled and you've seen so much throughout your career. Is there anything that you think is something that we should be paying attention to here in America that you've noticed is being developed in other countries that perhaps, you know, it might be a good idea to get some research and development started?
Well, in the biggest thing we talk about these days in the U.S., and I'll just concentrate on the U.S., is mode of transportation. In the area of mode of transportation, our gas prices are going up, and by the way, they're going up because we're having to drill deeper, further out in the oceans. Ergo, it costs more, and some of the climates we're having to drill in, be it the North Slope or the North Sea or off of Greenland, all of this leads to oil obviously with time going up. I'll leave aside the speculator issue because there's two ways to look at that. Speculators do actually provide a service in the free markets of the world. They take their losses and their benefits when they make their speculative bets. Where I'm going is I believe personally more in the all-electric world of the future. So I'm a supporter of the electrical vehicles and some of the other innovations in mode of transportation, starting with what I call a transitional go with natural gas, especially in fleet trucks. Mm. There's every reason to be fueling our truck fleets with natural gas. The problem with natural gas is distribution of that gas. Can we get it to the gas stations along the freeways of our country? Ditto, you know, you look at innovations, for instance, coming out of predominantly Japan, Russia, Israel, and some U.S. labs in better and better lithium batteries. The problems with the batteries at the moment is limited distance. In other words, the power density is not enough. Mm. But they're coming up with doping materials that will make that better and better. Even in India, a lot of people are poo-pooing it, but they're Tata, the huge Indian company, is coming up with an air car just using compressed air to drive a motor and then exhaust nothing but cool air. That sort of innovation, lots of people say, ha, little car. Lack of power, lack of distance. But for goodness sake, these are innovations that we should be looking at. It may be a small car. It may have problems related to questions of safety because it is a small car, crash tests. There's an issue of the air cylinder itself, 4,500 PSI. But I'll remind you, it's a tank, a pressurized tank that is not flammable. Air doesn't burn. So those problems can be solved. And all I'm getting at is we should be supporting and watching and using our government-funded or private investment-funded dollars to bring on these new ideas and get off our oil-dependent world.
I think that the whole concept is fascinating. And, you know, we have to remember that everything that we have today had to begin somewhere. So maybe the technology is immature at this point, but at least it's a starting point, and at least it's something that functions.
Sorry, I missed the point of the question. Sorry, June.
That's okay. It's the point that, you know, it's a starting point, and at least we have somewhere to go from instead of, you know, just being kind of left where we have no possibilities. So I think, you know, what you're describing is fantastic. It's just, you know, we have to keep going and continue to develop.
You're right. We certainly do have to keep going, and I'm just an advocate after being in the energy business for so long. An advocate of balance, an advocate of let's bring on all of the sources because we can use them and should use them all. There's just so many new technical ideas out there that deserve research and development dollars to bring them on and help create better reliability in all of our energy supply systems, not just electricity.
Mr. Drolet, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It was wonderful talking to you and learning more about your experience and also your opinions of what we really should be focusing on.
Super. Well, thank you for having me, June. My pleasure.
And folks, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Clean Energy View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon.